Good morning. We'll call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division to order. And we do have a quorum. The clerk will note the roll. We are going to move for adoption of the minutes. And since Representative Brand is not here, Representative Hamilton. So move the minutes. All right. Are there any additions or changes? Otherwise, those are the minutes for February 28th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So today we have one bill, and then we have a number of presentations. And then on Thursday we'll have a couple more bills, but those mostly will be laid over for possible inclusion. So today we welcome. I'm just going to begin because I'm going to have the testifiers come to the table, please. Yes, the testifiers. Yeah, there she is. Okay. So Representative Anderson. Oh, you just put something in your mouth. Could you come here and chair the meeting? Would you mind? Or Representative Hamilton, somebody, I'm going to need, if you don't mind. Yeah, I'm just going to go up and do this bill. So I think he's got it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Madam Chair.
So I'd like to move House File 1530 be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. And I have, this is the Animal Cruelty Reporting Immunity Bill. And with me, I have Dr. Sheftel, who's going to be able to present information about why we're bringing this bill forward and what we'd like to see happen. So,
good morning, Doctor. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, good morning. My name is Joni Sheftel. I'm a veterinarian. I'm president of the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. We have about 2,000 members in the MVMA. We appreciate the opportunity to address you today in support of House File 1530 regarding veterinary immunity for animal cruelty reporting. We appreciate, Chair Poppe, that you have authored this bill. In Minnesota, veterinarians have been mandatory reporters of animal cruelty for many years, and that makes sense, right? It's in our oath to protect animal health and welfare, and also the prevention and relief of animal suffering. Most of us assumed that along with mandated reporting, veterinarians were provided immunity for their good faith reporting in these situations. In our research of this law in other states, we found that there are 32 states that have mandated reporting by veterinarians. 29 of these states provide us with immunity, and 26 of these provide both criminal and civil immunity. Mandated reporting and immunity go hand in hand, and that's what we'd like to see happen here in Minnesota through the passage of this bill. We've had good discussions over the summer with our friends in the ag community about this issue, and they were very helpful in crafting the bill language. These discussions resulted in the addition of the provision pertaining to veterinarians not only acting in good faith, but also acting upon these situations in the normal course of business. We agree this latter phrase is important to include in the bill to confine reporting to those situations that veterinarians have experienced themselves with their own clients during their normal workday, precluding things like drive-by observations and reporting. Importantly, this bill also protects veterinarians in situations that involve cruelty in which the injured animal needs to be euthanized. The liability protections extend to veterinarians in performing necessary euthanasia when the animal is suffering and is beyond cure through reasonable care and treatment, as it's worded. You know, veterinary medicine is about animals, but it's really a people business, too. And fortunately, this type of thing we are talking about is very rare. However, if in the care and treatment of an animal we see signs of injury during our exam that we believe or suspect may be due to abuse or cruelty, then we are obligated by veterinary medical ethics and by the law to report situations to authorities. It's important for us to know that we will not be held criminally or civilly at fault for making an honest and good faith judgment to report. Veterinarians are trained, licensed professionals. We believe you can find examples of immunity provided to other Minnesota healthcare professionals for similar situations involving reporting abuse or neglect in the elderly or children, for example. Again, Chair Poppe, we appreciate the committee considering this legislative proposal, and we hope that you will support the veterinary community in approving House File 1530. I'm available for questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions from members? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. And I like the fact that you reached out to producers to get their input as well. And like you said, I think it's critical to have that language in there, good faith and in normal course of business, because this is dealing with vet-patient relationships. And so, again, I just want to say thank you for reaching out to the other stakeholders.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Poppe, thanks for doing this, and I hear everything, and this sounds really good, but I have to ask sort of like the paranoid question, if I could. Does this relate in any way to, like, we've talked about immunity of people going into livestock barns and some of those places? It has nothing to do with any of that, correct?
It doesn't.
Doctor?
Chair, Representative, it does not. In fact, that phrase is to prevent that sort of thing from happening. We know it's a serious, serious problem.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Doctor, have you checked with the livestock folks, Minnesota beef people, hog people? Are they okay with this language?
I would not speak for them, but we did work with commodity groups during the summer to arrive at this language. And perhaps there are others in the committee room that could speak to that if necessary.
Anybody in the audience who would care to testify either for or against the bill? Last chance. Doctor, one more question I had. I believe in some of the information on the bill, it also mentioned disposal of carcasses. Would this at all play into how that's done on a farm?
Mr. Chair, that phrase confused me also, but when you look back at the previous statute, what they mean by disposal is euthanasia.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. And one last question I would have when we dealt with tourism, liability for agritourism, we found out there were different degrees of liability. Does that play into effect here at all? Is it blanket liability? They are talking about different degrees of misdemeanors, that type of thing. Could you comment on that?
I'm sorry. That is a legal question I can't answer.
Okay. And see, nobody in the audience who would care to comment on that, we'll let that question go then. Any more member questions? If not, again, in the audience, anybody who would care to testify? Seeing none, Chair Poppe, would you care to renew your motion? Or any final comments that you would have?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that the Minnesota Chiefs of Police have a letter in support in the packet, so you have that information. And I do know that the work has been done throughout the summer and fall, I think, to really try to be narrow and precise in crafting this bill in order to be able to provide the veterinarians the comfort for the immunity and to hopefully work with all of the people so that they understand really the purpose behind it and in good faith. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to renew the motion that House File 1530 be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
That's the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Denied, same sign. Motion is passed. Thank you, Chair Poppe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Poppe, if I could, while we're here while we're transitioning.
Representative Miller, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When this moves to judiciary, and this is no disregard, this is no indictment on your testifier today, but they are going to be asking all those legal questions, right? So you might want to have phone a friend available. I'm in one of those committees, so I know what they're where they go. So just a word of caution. Thank you,
Representative Miller. So besides a veterinarian, we will also have an attorney. Is that what you're saying?
They will go there. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you for your support for that bill. And now we're moving on. So we're going to start out with the corn growers. We've got an opportunity to have some ag innovation during changing times testimony, and pleased to have a number of different presenters before us today. So the first few minutes will be spent with the Minnesota corn growers. So Brian Thalman and Dr. Mark Hillmeyer are here, and we're going to turn this over to them. And welcome to the committee. We're excited to hear what you have to say, so please go ahead and get started. Mr. Thalman.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Thalman. I currently serve as president of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to share information with the committee this morning about the Minnesota Corn Grower Association efforts focused on agricultural innovation, especially during the current difficult economic environment. I'll refer to our association as MCGA in my remarks. MCGA has over 6,500 members and represents all of Minnesota's 24,000 corn farmers through our research and education efforts. I farm together with my father and son near Plato, located 50 miles west-southwest of here in Plato, Minnesota. We farm 2,000 acres, corn and soybeans, and operate a seed cleaning facility. Minnesota corn farmers are continuously working to improve and become better stewards of our state's natural resources while maintaining a thriving rural economy. That's why MCGA made a commitment to an ambitious goal. Our goal is Minnesota corn farmers will become the most sustainable and environmentally responsible corn farmers in the United States. MCGA's approach to sustainability is made of three equally important elements, all of which are related and influenced to each other. They are people, planet, and profit. Farmers are always implementing new initiatives to take advantage of opportunities and to address challenges. Minnesota corn farmers have been making their own financial investments to add value to every bushel of corn that we produce. Today, I would like to highlight two ways that Minnesota's corn checkoff investments are setting the stage for a more profitable and sustainable future for all of Minnesota's corn farmers. First, ethanol and renewable fuel infrastructure and development. Second, sustainable polymers that offer a high-value, environmentally friendly replacement for petroleum in a variety of consumer and industrial products. The state of Minnesota has a long history of public policy and funding support for the development of value-added processing, including ethanol and other renewable fuels. Recently, a public-private partnership through the Biofuels Infrastructure Partnership leveraged $8 million in federal funding for ethanol infrastructure. A combination of federal and state funds, along with matching funds from partners, invested a total of $14 million in this ethanol infrastructure program. As a result, Minnesota recently surpassed 400 E85 service stations and 300 stations selling 88-octane fuel, also known as E15. This growth in ethanol sales has been impressive. In 2013, Minnesota sold a total of 42,000 gallons of 88-octane fuel. In 2018, our sales exceeded 59 million gallons. There's also been growth in E85, which is gasoline containing up to 85% ethanol. In 2013, We sold 13.1 million gallons of E85. In 2018, E85 sales reached nearly 19 million gallons. These impressive sales numbers demonstrate the value of public-private partnerships to help add value to Minnesota corn, support rural and urban economies, and use a fuel that results in cleaner air through fewer air emissions and reduced greenhouse gases in our fuel supply. Ethanol is not the only renewable and sustainable product that MCG has been investing in. Recently, our board of directors allocated nearly $500,000 in research funding to the Center for Sustainable Polymers at the University of Minnesota. Our leadership views this investment as a strategic opportunity to develop the next high-value and sustainable market for corn, the replacement of petroleum in a variety of consumer and industrial markets. Globally, it is estimated the market for renewable and sustainable products could exceed $450 billion. For example, corn could be the feedstock for a sustainable polymer that would replace petroleum in plastics, adhesives, sealants, printer inks, and construction chemicals, to name a few. To talk a little bit more about the research and innovation opportunity, I would like to turn the remaining time over to Dr. Mark Hillmeyer, who leads sustainable polymer research at the University of Minnesota and is a valuable partner with us, Minnesota Corn Growers.
Thank you, Mr. Thelman, and welcome to the committee, Dr. Hillmeyer. Please just state your name and then present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Hillmeyer. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also the director for the Center for Sustainable Polymers. This is a research outfit that's funded primarily by the National Science Foundation. I'm happy to be here, and I want to thank you for listening to what we have to say about this new partnership and about sustainable polymers in general. We use plastics and polymeric materials every day. They're central to everything we do, the cushion that you're sitting on, the clothes you're wearing, the packaging for your foods, the toothbrush that you use. So they're central to everyday life, but the current paradigm, I would argue, in the long run is non-sustainable. We harvest petroleum-based resources. Frankly, the chemical industry is very good and efficient at converting those into the products that we use every day. And a lot of those products actually benefit sustainability principles, lightweighting automotives, for example. But if you pick up a newspaper, pretty much you'll read almost every day something about the unfortunate consequences of indiscriminate disposal of these materials. They're in our landscapes, they end up in our oceans, and landfills, ultimately, many of them. So the picture that you see in front of you, the infographic, kind of gives the current paradigm, which is very linear. And the Center for Sustainable Polymers, first of all, we use much more optimistic colors. And second, we use something that's a little bit more circular, where, as you can see, corn and other bio-based products are the starting point. These are annually renewable resources. They can be turned into the molecules that are useful for the same exact materials and maybe new materials that provide these benefits that I spoke of. But ultimately, we think about much more sensible end of life, whether or not it's composting. I have a compost bin on my alley that I can put compostable plastics in that go to compost, even clean incineration. Or if they do get into the environment indiscriminately, they can rapidly degrade. This is a tall order. Because the petroleum industry has been doing this for decades, and they have an incredible head start on us, and they do a very good job of making some amazing polymeric materials. It all starts with the basic research. In the University of Minnesota, that's what we do. We generate knowledge, and the students will ultimately go out and innovate in the marketplace. It also requires translational research. How do we turn those basic ideas into something that could have value? And then ultimately technology transfer. So I'll just say a few words about each of those to introduce you to why I think this partnership with Minnesota Corn Growers is so important. So the Center for Sustainable Polymers was seeded by the University of Minnesota with an $800,000 grant in 2009. We used that money to establish the center and go to the federal government, and we were awarded a Center for Chemical Innovation. This is the biggest program in the Division of Chemistry at the National Science Foundation. In 2011, we competed to win the next phase, which is a $20 million grant. We won that in 2014, and in about 2 weeks, I'm going to the National Science Foundation to try to convince them to do it again for another 20 million. We work on the fundamentals, the molecule bending. I highlighted the word discover because we really want to discover what we need to do from a fundamental sense to be able to change the way the certain unsustainable paradigm is. With Minnesota Quorum Research Promotional Council support that Brian mentioned, this is the translation bit. How do we take those fundamental knowledge and new knowledge, maybe it was with something that was a little maybe more exotic, but we learned something interesting, and translate that into something that could have technological value. I've just listed some of these projects here. You might remember back to your chemistry days if you see 3-hydroxypropionic acid. But these are how do we turn that basic knowledge into real products? So we think work on things like film blowing and cellulose nanocrystals, all with corn as the ultimate starting material. Then how do we go to the next level? We have an industrial advisory board. You can see some prominent players here in the state of Minnesota, but also nationwide, where they give us guidance and feedback as to what the market trends are and where we should be paying attention. And we hope that they ultimately will license some of the technology. We have had startups come out of the center, and this is a way now to turn basic research through to translational research, ultimately to products. I'll end with the last bit that says this is a reality. NatureWorks is partly owned by Cargill. You've probably used one of their bio-based plastic cups. This is called PLA. This is polystyrene from back there. You can't tell the difference between them, and they both do the same job of holding a cold drink. This one comes from petroleum. It's essentially non-degradable at any time scale. Recyclers don't want it, okay, and it ends up going to landfill or incineration. This one comes from corn. It goes in your compost bin, and it composts CO2 and water in about 2 months or so in a compost. Why not do this one relative to this one? And cost is a big part of that, you can imagine. And the Center for Sustainable Polymers, our ultimate goal is to make the bio-based derivative, do the research to make the bio-based derivative the cheaper alternative. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for that. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Notice on the slide about your industrial advisory board, there's one petroleum company, BP. Do they embrace this, or do they push back, feeling loss of market share? What do you have to go up against with industry?
Thank you very much for that question. BP, ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical, each one of those companies has a sustainability link on their front page. But they sell petroleum-based polymers. So you're very right in that kind of ideological, maybe, that difference. But recycling, for example, is a big sustainability play. How can we more effectively recycle our polyolefin polymers? Many of those companies are interested in. BP is interested in, we get ethylene right now from petroleum. Could we get ethylene from ethanol? They have the same starting point, eth. And so they're actually very closely related chemically. So, in fact, there's a company that we're working with now. They're not quite a member of our IAB, but they're called Braskem. They make polyethylene from ethanol from sugarcane in Brazil. So, yes, the answer is even the traditional petroleum-based folks are very interested in sustainable alternatives to their traditional materials.
Next, we have Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation and for the work. I think it's very, very important. I'm just curious about this work and products and kind of where they are as far as scalability. So, like, for instance, we have compostable plastic bags, but they aren't yet kind of to the point of being able to scale out to replace plastic bags. Same with the cup that you mentioned. So I'm just curious about what you see as next steps, both for kind of moving some of these products into being more fully scalable, and if there are other products that you haven't mentioned that you think show us a lot of potential immediately for packaging replacement.
Yeah, packaging is the thank you, committee member. Packaging is the is kind of the big effort out there. How can we replace packaging that everything we buy in Walmart is more bio-based? And scalability is a big part of that. In partnership with the Minnesota Corn Growers, one of the things we're interested in, I put it back up here, is, for example, melt-blown PLA film. If we could solve that problem, it's hard to do now, if we could solve that problem, that could open up a lot of opportunities for plastic packaging. With respect to scale, maybe I'll let Brent say a word about this, is that you know, the ethanol scale is huge, and transportation fuels relative to sustainable plastics is a huge difference, maybe 20 to 1 in terms of scalability. So to the extent that maybe some of those ethanol plants could be converted, and there's history of this, into plants that could make bio-based plastic precursors, I'm not too concerned about that. Bigger problem is getting it scalable to compete with, as you said, the Braskems, the BPs and ExxonMobils, and the infrastructure for that. I'm going to give a lot of credit to NatureWorks, a Minnesota company, who has really led the way in this. They're at about a million kilograms a year production, and that material ultimately is starting to make market penetration, and as the price comes down, I think it'll be able to scale effectively. But maybe I'll let Brian say a word about that.
Mr. Thalman.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. I also serve on the board of Heartland Corn Products ethanol plant in Winthrop, one of 20 ethanol plants in Minnesota. We look at ourselves there as a bio-based factory, and you know, currently our biggest challenge is in excess of ethanol we're producing due to market factors we hope get resolved in the national level with the E15 and so on, marketing year-round. But in agriculture, it seems like we never have a problem overproducing, whether it's corn, whether it's soybeans, whether it's ethanol, whatever the case may be. That's where this ties together so well. We're just excited as we think about the different aspects of agriculture, of how, as Dr. Hillmeyer's projects can develop and find what particular components are needed. Our ethanol plants are all somewhat unique in that a particular facility could begin developing, producing a particular product. And currently the easiest approach is taking a kernel, removing the starch and producing ethanol. All the protein, all the fiber is left as dried distiller's grain as a high-value feed product, and we separate off corn oil. But we surely could create a different line of products coming off of that facility based on what's needed for a particular manufacturing process.
Thank you. Representative Lippert? Okay. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for being here today. This is a lot of really good stuff. And I have a question about biofuels. And as we continue to grow and evolve within biofuels, I really... Minnesota Corn Growers is in Shakopee, which is my district, so it's good to hear a lot about Minnesota Corn Growers and the great work they're doing. But it has always been my impression that as we continue to grow and move the ethanol industry forward, that there's been an intent to diversify and to be able to use more perennial plants and grasses and things like that for biomass for ethanol. And that seems to have stalled out a little bit from where that hope was originally. Where do you guys think that is going into the future for the ability to have more biomass come from other sources other than just corn and biodiesel with beans and that kind of thing?
Mr. Thalman.
Madam Chair, Representative, that has been a approach for the last, you know, 15 years or so, as at the national level, the renewable fuel standard had a target for corn ethanol production and also for some of the other advanced products. There's been development going on in the advanced products. A couple challenges. It's going to take a minute to describe all this, but I'm very passionate about it. As a corn producer, we have seen our yields consistently go up. We're producing more pounds of corn per acre and less pounds of fertilizer. On my own farm operation, if I go back 15 years, we would apply on average 200 pounds of nitrogen, produce 180 bushel an acre of corn. Now, we average 180 pounds of nitrogen, we're producing 225 bushel an acre of corn. So it's almost a one-third reduction in the amount of nutrients per bushel produced. Through this process, we're now harvesting 11,000 to 12,000 pounds of green corn per acre, and the acre is the size of a football field. So if you think about it, every year we put on 300 or 400 pounds of fertilizer. At the end of each year, we pull off 11,000 to 12,000 pounds of corn. We also produce about 20,000 pounds of vegetative material that stays on that acre if we don't harvest it to use it for producing advanced fuel. And that's made up of the stalk material and the roots. All of that organic matter stays in the soil, or in some cases they're harvesting some of the stalk material to try to produce some other products. By leaving it in the soil, that slowly decomposes, and over time, on our farm, we have raised the organic matter about 1% from, 3.5% to 4% up to about 5% organic matter. I verify this with other farmers in the state. We grow about 4 years of corn and then come back with 1 year of soybeans. It goes against people that want diversity. The reason we do it is that we're improving the soil. In the process, we come back and plant soybeans or wheat. We get a much better crop there because we've improved the soil tilth. So the concern over the years of, growing too much corn, in our opinion, is that it really helps the soil. So now, because of what I'm talking about, the efficiencies of increasing yields and so on of corn, if we try to go and use some kind of a ground cover, a different perennial type crop, and make that into ethanol, we can do that. But number one, our falls come, winters come pretty early in the fall, so if you try to harvest even corn stalks, it's a challenge. We can get the grain off the field in the fall. We're equipped to dry it and store it. You try to harvest corn stalks, you have to let them get dry first to get them baled. There might be snow on the ground. So these other crops, too, by the time you harvest them and go through the storage process, it just becomes very cumbersome compared to what you can haul and transport with grain corn. So we really think there's a better opportunity to find future uses for the kernel of corn, the kernel of soybeans, and still keep that plant factory growing out there. And there's going to be some other future crops, but in the near term, I think this is going to be much better off.
Yes, Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may not have been very clear with my question that I was asking there, but I'm more concerned about, the advances that we've made, and I'm a farm kid from Iowa, so I have spent lots and lots of time doing exactly what you just talked about. But my concern is as we continue to focus and work on water quality and sustainability and things like that, that there's very clear advantages to having not all, obviously, corn production land and row crop production land in other diverse crops, but as we look at the fact that we can have perennial grasslands and have that in CRP-type programs and still harvest biomass off there to be able to use for biofuels, there are tremendous opportunities that we have in doing those kinds of things for environmental effects, water quality, air quality, those types of things that as we move forward. So that was more where my question was, is where are we going and do we have the opportunities in the near future for being able to do those types of changes to how we utilize the land?
Mr. Feldman.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there's work being done there. Again, a lot of the challenges are, it's very expensive to operate a farm. The equipment we currently have is well suited for the row crops that we grow. We start looking at these new ventures. Some work and some don't. So do people go and get new equipment, and they've tried it, by packaging different forages to go to some of these ethanol plants, but they can use traditional balers, but handling the equipment or handling the raw ingredient is a challenge. So yes, there's work being done. I think we have to look at where we're looking. If you're in the flat country of south central Minnesota, that's one thing. If you're looking at some really rolling ground, we're worried about water erosion, then having permanent grass cover and so on has value. What I would challenge you with is you hear some of these reports about the good benefits of this. You start talking to people studying water quality, and you look at some of the areas where you've got an area of natural grass, for example. The runoff off of that will be much higher nitrates than off of a cornfield, for example. I mean, there's just a lot of natural processes, too, we have to take into account. So not answering your question directly, and we'll see where it all goes, but there's going to be places for everything moving forward.
Thank you. And we've got two more questioners. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Chair Poppy and members. I like the ending sentence that you just had. We'll see where the research goes, and I'm excited about this research, and I'm excited about other research that we have seen presented in committee. I wear glasses that are that are polymers that are from organic materials. So I think it's really great. It's a nice light product. There are great things that are happening with those polymers. My question is about whenever we say yes to one thing, we say no to something else as well. So when we're saying yes to using corn for this type of product, and are we also then saying no to low-cost corn for animal stock? And what happens to food cost as we go forward with this, and the sustainability of other farmers as we go forward with this? So I guess my question is there enough corn production to keep the cost of our food products low, specifically meat and the high value feed? And that's just kind of a general question that way. So is there enough?
Mr. Thalman.
Representative Poppy, the answer is yes. The entrepreneurial spirit of the American farmer always seems to outweigh the challenges of production. We're always producing more. You know, from a straight corn standpoint, corn grown for food is just a fraction of 1% in the sweet corn market compared to grain corn. The benefit of the ethanol production system is that we're pulling the starch out. There's plenty of starch in the world, but we need the protein, and the protein is all concentrated in the dry distillers' grains. And that is a sought-after, high-value animal feed product. So yields keep going up. And if there's an increase in corn or the soybeans, there's different protein sources. So yields keep going up, and the yields are far increasing current demand. And I don't think that's going to change.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fullman, thanks for being here. Corn growers, I think, do a very good job. You will financially incent folks to try different methods. You talked about the utilization of nitrogen, and you're right there trying to do that, and I say thanks for that. My question or comment is, I don't know if you had a chance to see the Star Trip this morning. There was a big article from General Mills, and I think they're going to work now with a million acres of production that they use in their food chain. Working, first of all, I think, with oats production, so not corn, but this whole idea of the sustainability, they had another word for it. But are you involved in talks like that with the major grain buyers to tell a story of how production is done smartly and in the right way? And is this a thing that is going to be coming on and we're going to have to be working with food companies to show we are sustainable? And the one thing I missed in the article was there was no incentive. They talked about improved soil health, things like that. And sometimes your yield would go down when you do things like cover crops and things. But are you involved in talks like that with some of these major food companies?
Mr. Thalman.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we are, through our affiliation with the National Corn Growers. I serve on one of 10 action teams at the national level, and our team deals with biofuels. One of the teams deals directly with sustainability. The last year or two, there have been huge advancements. The Walmarts of the world all want to be able to have some kind of a symbol on their package, whatever the case may be. So National Corn with some other trade groups are helping consolidate those efforts, and there is a huge push being done to work together with those people to promote the sustainability practices being done by both crop and livestock production. From a corn standpoint, there's also an emphasis on soil health. There's a group called the Soil Health Partnership that's been formed, and that group is doing specifically what you're talking about to document some of the advancements that I talked about on our farm. As we get that information documented and using 2019 data, it shows the great advances that have been made, And it's amazing using that data, what that shows versus, you know, 20-year-old data. So we are sustainable. We're doing what I think the industry wants us to do. We just have to get that message to the industry.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Very, maybe we will take some tours maybe this fall, and maybe we'll be going to the Center for Sustainable Polymers. That might be an interesting field trip. So,
Madam Chair, can I correct the record?
Yes.
Because I teach organic chemistry, and my students are always correcting me if I make a mistake. So I misspoke and said that this polymer was made at 1 million kilograms. It's made at about 1 billion kilograms, 1 million tons. Just to give you a sense of the scale, you know, the polymer production in the U.S. is, sorry, globally is hundreds of billions of kilograms. So it's a this is back to your question, a relatively small player, but I would argue that's where the opportunity for growth in the glasses and other things you heard about today can happen. So
thank you very much.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. So appreciate your time and the presentation today. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to bring down the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. We do have we're planning to be done by 11:30, so we want to make sure everybody has the right amount of time to be able to present and ask questions. Our last bit of time will be spent on industrial hemp, and so that might be the thing that would be shrunk a little bit if we're running out of time, because we want to make sure that the people that are here are able to provide their testimony and presentation, and that we are able to ask questions and get answers. So welcome to the committee, and we have Mr. Youngerberg and Mr. Skoug. So I'm just going to turn it over to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Poppy and members of the committee. My name is Mike Youngerberg. I am Senior Director of Product Development and Commercialization for the Minnesota Soybean Program. We're very excited to present to you today a project that we've been working on called the Soy Innovation Campus idea that we have been discussing with a number of partners that we have here in the state of Minnesota, from people like Epitome Energy, who you maybe heard of already, to our Ag Utilization Research Institute folks, to the University of Minnesota, to foster this idea that we can really make some headway into some of the things that we're asking about is new products and new innovations coming to agriculture. So we did have a short video that we would like to show to what the campus program is. So. Any sound?
Maybe what we'll do is we'll hold that until later. Keep working on it, and we'll.
Right, we'll play
because it's really just the sound that we're missing, right? So
try that one. We'll try the other computer.
Okay, all right, and then. Thank you. All right, we'll see if that's going to work with the sound. I think I can hear something. There we go.
Agriculture's impact on our state and our region is massive. No other industry has contributed more to our state's economy, our environment, and our way of life. But over the past few years, we've learned the hard way that selling a raw commodity to a single customer can be risky business. It's time for Minnesota to again evolve. We've evolved in southern Minnesota by creating processing facilities, biodiesel plants, increased our livestock production, and become a leader in global biofuel production. It's time for the northwest region of Minnesota to have the same opportunities. With the amount of soybeans now grown in that region, it's one of the largest soybean production areas in the United States. The quality of the beans are high, the availability is massive, and the price of those beans currently is well below market value. Crookston, Minnesota, positioned in the middle of 1.8 million acres of soybeans. That makes this community perfect for locating a new value-added processing center. But the availability of soybeans is just a start. This community has Class A railroad, high-capacity roads, and an abundant natural gas and water sources. Perhaps the most important part of this community is that its workforce is available, ready, and willing to make a project like this successful. Another unique asset of this community is its university campus, which holds tremendous promise for the future. Building on the tremendous assets of the Crookston area, Epitome Energy, along with local soybean producers, conducted an extensive feasibility study. The results of this study were obvious. Crookston is the right place to build. Starting with securing base investments, Epitome Energy will move quickly to working with regional and state agencies for the permitting process. Upon completion of permitting, construction will begin. First the roads, then access to water and pipelines for gas will be built. The crush capacity of this plant will be equal to 65,000 bushels per day. When construction begins, over 820 jobs will be created. That'll generate $134 million of economic activity in the state and primarily the region. The soybean meal created at this crush facility will be available to be railed to Mexico, Canada, China, truly all over the world. Much of it can be utilized right here in our region and can advance our animal agriculture. It is projected that upon completion of this crush facility, soybean prices in the region could rise as much as 20 cents per bushel. Unlike any other facility in the United States, the Soy Innovation Campus will be home to a small crush facility. It will have the ability to process GMO, conventional, even organic crops. What makes this exciting is that there'll be new opportunities for farmers in the region and new opportunities for research just now coming out of the university. This unique plant design will allow many types of groups to see exactly how processing occurs. The glass wall will allow students, international visitors, and businessmen from all types of industries to come in and see the processing. They'll be able to see firsthand new technologies being tried at this facility. Hopefully, they'll be able to take those technologies and incorporate them in their plants, creating new jobs and new opportunities all across Minnesota and across our great country. Upon completion of the crush facility, the biodiesel plant will start to be built. This 30 million gallon biodiesel plant will utilize the oil left behind from the nearly 59,000 tons of identity preserved soybean meal that was processed through the plant. Production from this biodiesel plant is perfectly matched to assure we are purchasing Minnesota grown and processed fuel required by the B20 mandate. The B20 mandate has set the bar for our nation, showing just what can be done for clean air and renewable fuel usage. By sharing resources with the university and with a large plant, we'll be able to build world-class laboratories and classrooms. These classrooms will help the university to teach future generations of process engineers. These process engineers are needed all across Minnesota in all types of manufacturing facilities. Students earning processing degrees at the Crookston facility will now have real-world hands-on experience, making them more valuable to many industries across Minnesota.
Over the last decade, the Chekhov Organization has invested in dozens of projects. Some of them have made it to market, but many of them have not, because there was no place to truly prove their viability. When completed, the campus will spawn new businesses, private businesses, many of which will have the opportunity to prove their technology in this small crush facility, will now have access to co-products from the large crush facility. This will reduce their cost of production and increase the stability of all of the business on the campus. This will give them access to lower priced feedstock and will strengthen the economic viability of the campus.
By working together, we can make this opportunity happen. The Crookston business community, the University of Minnesota, our state's legislature, and of course, our region's farmers. We can build a new opportunity. One that won't only impact the Northwest region of Minnesota, but will impact our state and ultimately the world.
Thank you. Mr. Youngberg, continue.
As the Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the video has done a great job of trying, you know, putting a very interesting approach to this campus project that we're working on. It's important to remember that this area of the northwest area of the state has while it's been growing in soybean production, certainly has suffered probably more in the price area just because we don't have value added in that area. So this is certainly the our attempt to work with others to make that happen. The added on top of that, the recent concerns with the trade issues and at a federal level certainly have exacerbated a number of these problems. So moving ahead as quickly as possible with this effort seems to be the right thing to do at the right time. Certainly, we're interested in the large crush and the biodiesel facility. We're also very interested in what the video talked about, a small crushing facility. We have been working with the University of Minnesota over a number of years on soybean varieties that have special use type things. We run into a problem of being able to special process those to preserve all the value of them. So that's one of the advantages. We also have been hit by, when we go to look at having some of these specialty beans processed, there's only a very few places in the U.S. that can do small batches of product, and they charge dollars per pound versus dollars per bushel or cents per bushel to get things processed. So, we can do feeding trials. I mean, we can't move forward without adequate research to move these products. So the other opportunity this facility location would have would be to process other types of crops, not only soybeans, but as the campus continues to develop, it can process some of these other things like the kernza and camelina and pennycress types of crops that people are talking about. With the technology there to do various kinds of processing, we can do a lot of myriad of different things and create additional value-added products coming from that. So as we look at the ownerships of these, the Epitome Energy will be the owner of the large crush and biodiesel plant. The small plant will be owned as a nonprofit with a board made up of constituents such as AURI, the University of Minnesota, and others to ensure that when we have specialty type things that we can run, we have space, say we had 1 week out of the month that we could run specialty type products, the other 3 weeks out of the month we could basically be a side stream to the large plant, just crushing regular beans and adding to the capacity there. So, there's a myriad of these connections that we believe can really be made to advance not only the soybean varieties but other crop processing and education in that area. The city of Crookston has been a very eager and willing partner to this. As the video mentioned, there's 100 acres in that particular site, so lots of room for other added value product things to come to the marketplace. We think that its proximity to the University of Minnesota's Crookston campus is a huge bonus across the board. You get cross-training and opportunity to actually go get your hands dirty in a processing plant somewhere, and that has value to itself. And it's also situated, you know, in an area that you know, is growing soybeans that are really some of the best, you know, that we have. And always the challenge is we always say we're the farthest from any markets, from the East Coast, West Coast, and Mexico, Gulf of Mexico. So we have to be more innovative than anybody to make our farmers profitable. So with that,
thank you, Mr. Youngerberg. And we will we've got about 4 more minutes. So, Mr. Skaug,
yes.
You want to state your name and then present your testimony.
Yep. Madam Chairman and members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Mike Skaug. Along with my wife and our son and his wife, we represent the fourth generation of farmers in Polk County. My ancestors came to this country in 1879 following the Homestead Act of Abe Lincoln. And after arriving in 1879, they settled in Polk County in 1881. And currently, our farm, it consists of raising soybeans, corn, and spring wheat. And I'm also serve on the, I'm one of the directors on the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association board representing Polk County. In 2018, Polk County farmers planted more than 326,000 acres of soybeans, more than any other Minnesota county. The 11-county region that would benefit most from a new soybean crush and biodiesel facility plant nearly 2 million acres of soybeans each year, making it one of the top soybean-producing regions in the entire United States. Because of a combination of factors, many of which are out of our control, we need help finding more value-added uses for our soybeans. This proposed facility will fill the growing need for value-added agriculture in northern Minnesota. Because we rely heavily on exporting our beans via railway to the Pacific Northwest, these facilities will ensure more of our high-quality soybeans are being used right here in Minnesota rather than shipping our commodities overseas. There's a huge demand for untapped potential for growth in northwest Minnesota. To that end, the job outlook in many northwestern Minnesota towns is bleak, and many of these towns are in desperate need of an injection of innovation. These projects aims to level the tax and economic playing field by affording northern growers the same opportunities for growth and value-added products as southern Minnesota farmers do. Farmers, like any other business owner, are always looking for ways to increase their revenue, and this proposed crush and biodiesel facility aims to improve the bottom line of Minnesota farmers. The University of Minnesota study estimates that a fully operational soybean crush and biodiesel facility would increase the price of our soybeans to growers 10 to 20 cents per bushel. With the cash value of soybeans in the Crookston area hovering around $8, which is one of the lowest in the nation, that 10 to 20 cents would increase would have a meaningful impact on our area farmers. The Soy Innovation Campus would be a game changer for northern Minnesota farmers, and we are eager to see this come to fruition. Thank you for this time and for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. We've got time for one question. No. All right. I don't see any questions. Oh, but Representative Peel.
Oh, Madam Chair, I probably don't have a question. I have heard from the growers quite a bit, and actually Mr. Skaug and I are neighbors. so, and if this plant comes to fruition, I will drive by it every time I go to town. So it's not far from my home. But I think I want to emphasize the fact that this is an important investment in rural Minnesota, and we do grow some really good soybeans there. But as they pointed out, it's very difficult to get them to market, and 20 cents is a big deal. Even 10 cents is a big deal, an increase in our bottom line. So I'm really hoping that this happens, but I think it would be very good for the economic value of the valley, but Minnesota in general. And I really appreciate the fact that the University of Minnesota, AURI, and soybean growers are all a part of this project. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Appreciate that you came forward today. And certainly people will be able to reach out to you to get some more information if they need
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes. Members of the committee.
Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
All right. So now we're bringing down the University of Minnesota Regional Sustainable Development Project. We've heard a little bit about this before, but we've got Dr. Drager and David Abbas, who is here. And so we're going to bring you forward. There we go. Get everything out of the way. Perfect. All right. Welcome to the committee. So I'm going to just, I don't know who wants to begin. I think Dr. Drager. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please just state your name before you begin your testimony and information.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Kathy Drager, and I'm the statewide director of the U.S. Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. I am also an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, so I've appreciated hearing from our colleagues in the Corn Growers and Soybean Growers Association prior to our discussion. Today, you've invited us here to talk about agriculture innovation in changing times. And I wanted to first start by thanking the Minnesota Legislature, which formed our program, the University of Minnesota Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, in 1997 and then again in 1999. A tip of the hat to Senator Leroy Stumpf, who also is from the Red River Valley. We just heard our corn growers, our soybean growers. The regional partnerships have a different model. In fact, it's a nationally unique model of addressing agricultural issues in the state of Minnesota. And you've heard a lot. I mean, the Palmer's presentation was fabulous. You know, how our colleagues and farmers and growers associations in the state of Minnesota, how they really look to their University of Minnesota to help move our state forward with other innovations, technology, and advances. So the regional partnerships have a little bit of a different model in that we were formed by the legislature to make sure that people throughout greater Minnesota, regardless of their political connections or their status having been a university grad or otherwise, that they have access to their land-grant university in this state. And so I'm going to start in your packet. I did add an old copy of the Fillmore County Journal, which reported on the legislature forming this program. And this says, it's an article about Robert Solem, who was a soybean grower. And at that time when this article was written, 1999, it looks like he had 1,100 acres of soybeans and corn. And he was the president of the Farm Bureau for Houston County. And basically, this article says that the Minnesota legislature developed the regional partnerships in 1997 as a way of connecting rural citizens with the University of Minnesota research resources. Simply speaking, the article says, The legislature put money aside so that citizen groups could fund practical research at the University of Minnesota, just like any other private company that funds applied projects or research at the university. And that the RSDPs will be able to compete for the use of U of M research and laboratory resources. So essentially, what our program does, and at this point, I would refer you to, we have a brochure that I put in here. Essentially, what our program does is we have five boards around the state. These boards are actually two-thirds community members and one-third U of M faculty. And those boards are actually decision makers with U of M resources. So they can direct those resources to whatever needs the community brings forward. And I'll just give you, you know, one quick example of what some of those projects look like. Some years ago, the Minnesota Grape Growers Association approached us. At that point, there had never been a real comprehensive economic feasibility. Grape growing was, we're seeing it increasing as interest. The U of M has a robust grape breeding program. And so we were able to bring in a graduate student and an applied economics faculty member, Professor Gartner, as well as the Grape Growers Association. And between our regional boards and the support of the Grape Growers Association, we did the first economic impact statement for grape and wine growing in the state of Minnesota, which was then reported back to the legislature. So this helps farmers who are trying to understand, find, build niches, and to innovate on their landscape. But it also helps university faculty. And I do have a quote here from Professor Gartner, who said that the regional partnership money, so we do have project funds that we're able to allocate, the partnership money led not only to my involvement with Minnesota Grape Growers Association, but also to my work with Northern Grape Projects, which includes now over a dozen states. And he goes on to say, without the support of the RSDPs on the study, it is highly unlikely that I or the U of M would be involved with the economic impact policy and branding studies with the Northern Grapes partners, Grape Projects. I think the partnerships were forward-thinking when they agreed to fund the study. So you could say the partnerships were forward-looking, but I would make the case that the innovation in this case didn't come from the partnerships, or necessarily in this case from the university, but really came from people in greater Minnesota who saw a need, saw a niche, and were interested in seeing more information and research be done on this area.
Just as you pause there, Representative Millers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to support you. Great example of giving the grapes. You know, agritourism is a thing that's legitimately growing out in our region. People are traveling out to the different wineries. I have about three or four in my area. The one that I have that I want to tout that would go directly to what you're saying is we have Hinterland Vineyards outside Clara City, and their wines and their award-winning wines are made with 100% of the grapes that are grown on their property, meaning they don't bring in in the past, a lot of wines would have the local grapes, but then they'd bring in the juices from California and stuff. Their wines and their winning awards with them are 100% grown on a Clara City farm. So good work.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate hearing that. And so we've done that work around the state. It started off in one region of the state and spread around the state so that we could support these growers wherever they are. And I am talking today about our sustainable agriculture and food system work, but really we also address a number of issues that rural communities bring to us for rural resilience, natural resources, and clean energy as well. But since we are in the Ag and Food Finance Policy Committee, I'm just limiting my remarks to the work we do on food. Typically, we do about 120 to 150 projects a year. All those projects have both community members and university members, faculty, students, and staff, like University of Minnesota Extension. And so what I want to also say is that this program has stayed very true to the legislative intent. It's absolutely, we have our bedrock principles, which were put into place by the people who founded this program, like Robert Solem, who was one of our founding board members in Southeast Minnesota. And that has seeded a lot of innovation in the agricultural system throughout the state of Minnesota. It really helps that we have staff embedded and living and working in all five regions of the state. Our board members are made up with regions from people in those regions. And in addition, each of our five regions of the state has a work group which engages another 100 people in helping us prioritize what we do. So we're really well connected. But it also helps if you hear of issues in your community that maybe don't have a legislative or policy impact. There's an opportunity for you as a legislator to direct your citizens towards us. At our website at rsdp.uofm.edu, we have an idea brief. It's a simple three-question, toggle a couple boxes, answer a couple of questions, and you bring this in. And the executive director in your region, and we serve all of Greater Minnesota, but our projects also link back with some issues in the metro area. But really, the legislature formed us to make sure that rural Minnesota had a voice at the university as well. But this is a good way to get into our program as well. So that's our idea form, and I did put one of those in your packet. And as I said, I think that's an opportunity that you could share with your constituents to have the university go to work on whatever issue it is they're addressing in their regions. So the regional partnerships call themselves something of a center court where community and university can meet. So this provides a place where we can share ideas and issues and innovations and needs. I will tell you that one of the first board meetings that I went to, it was actually in Southwest Minnesota, and two board members, a conventional farmer and an organic farmer, both had pretty large farms. They both showed up, and an agenda item was that they were going to open their books to each other and to the boards, and they were going to say, how is my conventional farm profitable? What does my books look like? How is this organic farm profitable, and what does it look like? And it was for someone newly working at the university and sitting at a table with farmers and another full professor of agronomy to hear these farmers really discussing how their operations work and how it actually made money. It was a really enlightening conversation. And both of those farmers and the entire board walked away with a fuller understanding of the agricultural sector in Southwest Minnesota, as well as faculty members. They are learning from communities in this case so that we can help to address the needs that the community has. As I said, every project that we work on, the brochures, we had 128 projects this year. It looks like for this 2019, it looks like it'll be closer to about 150. All those ideas come in through our idea brief. We're very bottom up. Bring in the ideas, and then our work groups and our boards narrow it down to the projects that we actually support. And really, what makes this an innovation is that the issues of our time require not just an academic approach to these problems, but also an applied and practical that comes from having that experience on the ground. And David's going to talk at length about one production technology that came from a farm, and we have been able to work to expand. That's called a passive solar deep winter greenhouse. And the amount of research that we've done helping to build out that farmer innovation.
Thank you. Should we transfer then to Mr. Abbas, because I think otherwise we might run out of time.
Okay. Why don't we? I just wanted to show one more innovation on supply chains. And so, yeah, if you want to just.
About 10 years ago, my husband and I decided to buy his family farm in western Minnesota. And so we moved our family out here. And being accustomed to shopping at, you know, co-ops and farmers markets, it was kind of a stark reality to be in a rural place that is a designated USDA rural food desert, meaning it has very limited access to the full range of groceries. So you're asking me why we don't have more local food in a rural grocery store that's located in the heart of some of the most productive farm country in the world? That's a good question. I'm Kathy Drager, and I'm turning empty trucks into big business for Minnesota farmers and grocers.
I'm Bonnie Carlson. I own Bonnie's Hometown Grocery in Clinton, Minnesota. People say it's the heart of the home, you know, as far as the town, because if you don't have a grocery store in town, they're going to go out of town to get groceries, they're going to go out of town to get their gas, they're going to go out of town to eat, they're going to go out of town and do everything. So we need to keep as many businesses open in our little town as we can.
Because you only can carry so much at a time.
Yep, you can.
So the advice that was given to me about growing a new crop was make sure you have a market first, making sure you have a way to sell it. I didn't follow that advice very good. We love to grow it, but it's the marketing for us. We don't have a strong point of marketing.
Well, Kathy, once she heard that we were doing this, I want to help.
And then once she heard that we were growing more than we could sell, she says, we need to find a way to fix that. So she got to work.
So that's where the backhaul project comes in. The overall idea is that we have farmers like Les and Russ who are producing a premium crop, and they need a market outlet. Bonnie could use another source of income and another way that she gets fresh farm produce into her store. And we have a wholesale truck that is in this community twice a week. So we just connect the dots. Farm to grocery to wholesale.
So for this case with this garlic is that Russ grows it. He then brings it to the grocery store in Clinton, and then the goal of that is that we will pick up that product, bring it back on our trucks, and then have it re-enter that supply chain. So it's almost a backwards integration.
We get truck deliveries every Tuesday and every Friday. And, you know, we're like one of the first stops, but by the time he goes back, his trucks are pretty empty. So why not try to see if they can fill the trucks up and make use of that truck and haul things back to the warehouse to try to sell to other stores?
A premium local product like garlic is the perfect crop to test this backhauling on because it's small, so it's a compact crop. It's high value, and it can be stable at room temperature. So it's an absolute perfect crop to test backhauling with. This hasn't been done in this way ever before. University of Minnesota has post-harvest handling expertise and faculty, so we work with them to make sure that the crop is being handled in a way that we get the maximum quality. And finally, what's the big question? How's this going to work economically? So we brought in applied economics. We have a PhD student and a faculty member who are working with us so that we can price this crop in a way that the farmer, the wholesaler, and the grocer all can share in this profit.
She cares. It's really fun to work with people that, you know, care and they want to change things. And the U of M's really done a solid job of keeping the project moving and making forward progress.
The backhauling project is a great tool for us to use, and we can try this market out.
We're trying to do something local and trying to support that and see if we can get more business because of it.
Because here we are in farm country. We should have access to really good, fresh food. Especially in these small town rural grocery stores.
Okay. So we'll turn it over to Mr. Abadis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
All right. I'll get this up just a sec. All right.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, representatives, yes. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you about innovations in Northeast Minnesota and throughout the state. My name is David Abadis. I'm a farmer. I've been on the town board the last 20 years and just been hired as the executive director of Northeast Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. So I've been with the extension for 3 months.
I was in the founding board of RSVPs 22 years ago, but this is my new role. One of the things that I wanted to touch on, and I will be brief but thorough, is the Deep Winter Greenhouse. It's a project throughout the state. And how do they work? Fortunately, one of my favorite representatives, Rob Eklund, came in the open house and spoke. This is a neat new technology where it's been experimented throughout the United States by individuals. The university, with the technology and the research, pulled it together into, frankly, I was skeptical, but an incredibly good design. Skeptical with the technology. The first one that was built was in Findlay, Minnesota, my hometown, and I was part of the building of it. And when I went into the building after it was designed, you can see how it works. It sucks the air out of the top part of the greenhouse and runs it through a well-insulated bed of rocks and then releases it back along the front windows. So it's a way of storing heat during the hot part of the day and then providing it at night. And I tell you that that first year, the heater rarely came on, so the technology worked well. In fact, before we had the motor hooked up, I walked in there, and it was 170 degrees in there. Once we hooked up the electrical, it went down to 85 and started heating those rocks. So very incredible insulated technology that is being looked at and expanded to see what applications it can provide in our colder climate. This research has been done throughout the state using these five because they're in the basic, the four corners in the center. And the research, which we've had help with Minnesota Solar Lab, with the legislature, with the MinDrive Global Food Systems and MinDrive Sensors, we've put 2,000 sensors into these units to get a better idea on how they're working and how the future designs will be reevaluated. So this is another neat way of bringing the university and the power and the ingenuity of communities together to create a new technology that I think will be very promising for years to come. Now, the RSDPs also looked at high tunnel research years before it started to become a movement. Now in our region, there are loads of new high tunnels through the NRCS EQIP program, and small farms throughout our region are creating these and building these for increasing production, increasing the length of availability of foods, getting customer loyalty, and increased farmer revenue. One nod to the corn growers. What we need is a plastic film that will cover greenhouses for a sustainable way of covering all these new greenhouses we're installing throughout the state. So go polymers. One of the other things that I've been working on over the last few years, and the RSDPs have been very supportive, they basically, the university asked, can we feed ourselves in the state of Minnesota? What does that look like? And so I worked, was one of the investigators with this project with Stacy Stark and David Searing, and we were answering, in the hardest place in the state, Northeast, can we feed ourselves there? And so we looked at populations, we looked at slopes, buildings, roads, how much land is tied up in the boundaries, how much land is available, what's wet, what's dry. And then we only included land that was cleared, so there's no conflict with logging, which is an important industry in our area. And then we only included land that was average or above fertility. And when we did that, out of the 18.4 million acres of this food shed, we'd call it, 1.69 million acres is available to grow. And if you look at the two diets, the standard American diet, I call it the SAD diet, we need about 500,000 acres to grow 83% because we can't grow all of the food that's in the standard American diet. I also put together a group of dietitians, diabetes experts, and they developed a 100% local diet. They were like, is that possible? And I said, you tell me, is it possible? They ended up coming up with a very good healthy diet that would provide 100% of this region's, the Western Lake Superior region, and it would require about 370,000 acres, but more farms because of the change of diet to more vegetables and fruits. So there's an economic benefit revealed through this research of almost $1 billion of money recycling, within our region, and then there's a jobs benefit with not only the jobs, 7,000 farmers directly, but also additional related food industry jobs. So if it can be done in northeast Minnesota, it can be done anywhere, and that's what the research has shown. With this, we've had a great increase of new farmers in Lake Cook, Carlton County. So while the trends are removal of farms from the rural landscape, those three counties of our region actually increased the number of farmers. A lot of that is a tip to the young farmers, the Farm Beginnings classes, the SFA, and the RSDPs, all putting energy into this to renew and grow a new economy that's based on the next generation of farmers. So this is a very important thing. They're doing CSAs, they're doing farm shares, they're doing farmers markets, direct markets to restaurants, and these types of things. Another innovation is clean energy. One of the things farmers can do is try and control their energy costs, one through conservation, and the RSDPs, the partnerships. Our leader in one of our four focus areas is CERTS for clean energy. You might be familiar with them. They're working with farmers, in fact, 36 farmers last year, to look and assess at their farm and see how they can do a capital cost up front to make their costs ongoing and stable throughout time. So you're looking at solar, you're looking at wind, you're looking at biofuels. There's a nod to the soybean growers. On our farm, we actually used waste vegetable oil from restaurants, converted our car, that's our car there, so we got to deliver vegetables with waste vegetable oil to our customers. One efficient, about 12 cents a gallon, 45 miles per gallon, but also a good marketing ploy for our customers wanting to support that. We've got wood heat innovation going on with CERTS. This is a poultry operation in Albany, Minnesota. This is probably one of the most replicable options out there for certain situations. So looking at renewable energies, another thing that I think has great promise in Northeast and throughout the state is biochar, the research and potential. NRRI has a new unit that I'm going to be exploring later this month, and Rob Eklund and I hopefully will go together to check out this site, and looking at how this technology can be used in our communities and supported by the loggers. I've done a lot of research with biochar, and you can see that one high bar. That's a biochar ash combination that was 10 times more effective than the biochar alone or the ash alone or even the lime and biochar. So other research going on with production, so it has a potential for nutrient retention, pH adjustment, also has the potential for carbon sequestering. So this is a really great opportunity. I want to put a nod out to one of my neighbors. He's a logger because as we got talking, the agriculture, the farmer, the family farmer, and the family logger have a lot in common. Highly capitalized operations with low margins. And so this kind of synergy between producing energy through biochar production, but also producing biochar to apply to agriculture fields and export throughout the rest of the state and elsewhere, has a great potential to lift up the family operations both in agriculture and farming. So there also is Farm to School program, which you've heard about. We started at Wolf Ridge, and the idea of this operation, and it had a lot of support from the RSDP. I was managing this farm at the time, and basically we had our curriculum. We teach to about 1,500 kids every year, and this brings education in a real way to all the urban and rural folks that come to Wolf Ridge, about 15,000 each year. We're hope, the goal is to produce all the vegetables and eggs for the 160,000 meals served in this credited school. And it's not only the education of the kids, it's the education of the next generation of farmers, teaching them. These are graduate students from around the country that do graduate courses at Wolf Ridge through Antioch. So there's a lot going on. I could talk about soldier fly larva composting or agrophenology. There's so much new and exciting going on innovation in a changing time. With that, I just want to say, you know, this is a great opportunity with the RSDP in my new position to really work more to connect communities with the incredible resources of the university and kind of, you know, really address those real issues on the ground level so that we can create a world with sustainable solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abbas. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Mr. Abbas, thanks for coming. What can the legislature do to help you support you in your work?
Mr. Abbas.
Well, I'll pass that to my boss.
Madam Chair, Representative Eklund, our program is about half of it is funded by Ag State Special. The other half is through grant writing for specific projects, and we also have private donors who step up to support our student programming. I would say that the fate of some of those legislative funds. We receive funding from the Department of Agriculture. I know the Good Food Access Fund is something that will be heard in this committee. Our work with rural grocery stores has benefited, as grocery stores around the state have benefited from that. I know that the AGREET funding is something that has come through this committee as well. And we access some of the faculty that have been hired with those AGREET funding. Those are three sources of fund that are legislative oriented that really support the work of this program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if anybody gets a chance to see one of those deep winter greenhouses, they're really quite an operation.
Thank you. Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, thank you to Representative Eklund for helping to get Mr. Abbas here today. I really appreciate this. I want to talk a little bit more about the new farmers portion that you talked about, so new farmers in Northeast Minnesota. What is happening there? Why do you think that is happening? What opportunities are helping to create an environment that is happening, and what's the general size of the farm and what they're producing?
Great. Madam Chair, Representatives, thank you for the question. It's exciting because we're breaking all the trends. I think in Northeast Minnesota there's been, from 10 years ago when that research was done, the idea that we could grow all our own food in Northeast Minnesota, which is hard to get food into that region, so it provides a great opportunity. So there's economic opportunity because of the nature of the environment. The Good Food Charter has been supported by City of Duluth. A lot of the big institutions are working with farmers to try and build those channels and supply chains. So right now, I think there's a good environment for the smaller, more intensively cropped vegetables, fruits that are growing throughout the state, but especially in Northeast with the varied topography, smaller acreage, also lower capital inputs to get started. Land access is a real challenge for young farmers. So I think it's a combination of a lot of people working really hard in our region to promote the localization of our food between the Superior Compact and the Charter. RSDP has funded it over the last 20 years. And the idea is these are seed funds that grow into bigger projects, and they have. So I've been on the recipient of that. I've also now am administrating that. And so I think with the also the Farm Beginning curriculum that was done through LSP, that was then administered through the SFA up there, provides a realistic look to young farmers how to make money, because a lot of them are idealistic, and how do you give them the tools to be productive. So I'm hoping there's a resurgence throughout the state. I think there's a lot of potential growth for direct marketing and marketing that also includes values around soil health and other issues that consumers can really support and lift up.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just follow, I miss it, or did you say, what's the acreage that generally?
Small. So I would say between 5 and 20 acres is a typical farm size for the intensive vegetable cropping. And you're looking at $40,000 gross sales per acre, a typical type of revenue. So it's more intensive. In fact, I had a Carmen, who I think spoke to this group, he came and visited me up at my farm. He says, wow, it's a lot of work. And it's just a small acreage because he has equipment and big fields and grain. We have small fields, intensive cropping, hand labor, and lots of workers. So there's differences of the different type of agriculture creates different workforces and different labor needs.
So. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Abbas and Dr. Drager. Thank you very much for the presentation today. Appreciate it. Thanks for traveling down, Mr. Abbas. We have one final piece of information. So we have Whitney Place, Assistant Commissioner, MDA, to talk about the industrial hemp industry. And we will have a couple of bills on hemp on Thursday. So she will provide some testimony, and we have additional support if we need it. Is that correct?
Yes.
Go ahead, Ms. Place.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Whitney Place, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and thank you so much for having me today to talk about making an old crop new again with our industrial hemp program in Minnesota. And just for a little background information, so the 2014 Farm Bill actually allowed state departments of agriculture to develop research pilot programs to study the growth, cultivation, or marketing of industrial hemp as an agricultural crop. So in 2015, the Minnesota legislature passed the Minnesota Industrial Hemp Development Act, so statute 18K, and this act allowed for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to develop one of those research pilot programs. That statute defined industrial hemp as cannabis sativa L with a delta 9 THC content of 0.3% by dry weight or less. And I can have my scientists talk a little bit more about that if there are questions. So our first growing season in Minnesota was in 2016, after the passage of that act. That allowed interested parties who wanted to grow hemp to register with the state and obtain a license. And that registration and license entails a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension background check, fingerprints, a detailed map of growing sites, stated research goals and deliverables, an MOU signed with the state of Minnesota, and a payment of fees. So we are proceeding with the pilot program. The passage of the 2018 Farm Bill actually changed some things, and so we are waiting for guidance from USDA. But so far this year, so I should say in 2016 we had 7 growers. So far this year in 2019, I'm happy to say we have 260 hemp licenses signed already. 155 of those are growers, and 105 of those are processors. In the 2019 growing season, we have 2,600 proposed outdoor acres and about 405,000 indoor square feet with applicants in 63 of the 87 counties in Minnesota. So as I mentioned, the new Farm Bill changed some things in the landscape of industrial hemp. So first, industrial hemp was removed from the Controlled Substances Act. Hemp is now considered distinct from marijuana and is recognized as an agricultural crop by the federal government. The process in terms of how we are going to go about administering the industrial hemp program, states and tribal governments have to submit a plan to the federal government. And now states are currently waiting for guidance from the USDA to submit that plan. And on February 27th, USDA announced that they are going to have guidance for states by fall of 2019 so that we can get our guidance plans submitted to them before the 2020 growing season. So at this time, we're just kind of administering the program as is under the auspices of the pilot project. The Farm Bill opened interstate commerce, so that allows our growers to be able to move seeds, plants, processed hemp products across state lines, which is very helpful because originally we were getting seed from Ukraine and Canada, and it was a pretty complicated process. And it also allows hemp growers to qualify for federal and state agricultural programs. So now hemp farmers are eligible for crop insurance, and that's done things like open up banking and financial opportunities for our growers as well. As far as opportunities with industrial hemp, we at the Department of Agriculture see a lot of opportunity. For grain production, we have some anecdotal reports here. One grain processor is building a cold press facility and will be purchasing hemp grain for Minnesota growers this year. Hemp grain is selling for 40 cents a pound for conventional grain and about $1.10 per pound for organic grain. We have a lot of interest in the fiber area, so developing rope, carpet, upholstery. The price for hemp fiber is about $80 to $100 per metric ton. There's a lot of interest in construction materials, pelletizing hemp for energy production, and then also CBD. And so that is an area where about 75% of our applicants in 2019 are interested in the production of CBD. Five companies are currently purchasing hemp for CBD extraction in Minnesota, with the expectation of increasing by the end of the year. CBD can bring in between $28,000 and $90,000 per acre, depending on the content and quality. So something that the Farm Bill did not do was change or modify the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So CBD and other cannabinoids are still considered illegal by FDA in terms of in food and in drugs. And so we are working with our partners at the federal government. And on March 1st, the FDA announced that they would begin hearing public testimony, or they would be having hearings on regulatory options for CBD. So I think that the need for clarity from FDA has been well vocalized to them, but it does kind of leave this gray area. And I just also do want to state that everyone in the supply chain who is producing CBD wants this to be a very safe and legal product. And we are definitely working with the other agencies in the administration to make sure that we come up with the best options for our growers and also for consumers of the product. In terms of developing the hemp industry, MDA does have several existing programs that hopefully can help hemp farmers. Out of the Agri Grant programs, we have crop research grants, value-added grants, and others that, you know, we're getting applications from hemp growers and processors. So they're applying just like any other crop or any other agricultural industry. We also have a couple of Minnesota-grown registered hemp growers, so we're excited about the prospect of having Minnesota-grown labeled hemp. And additionally, in Minnesota, AURI has really taken on a leadership role in helping to develop the markets for industrial hemp. They're working with several entrepreneurs and companies on a multitude of different products, and they've also worked on a feasibility study for the industry. Unfortunately, no one from AURI could be here today, but and some of the work that they're doing is also, you know, kind of secret. But they are making lots of strides in, you know, developing industrial hemp markets for our growers. So we at the department see industrial hemp as having real potential to develop a strong industry in Minnesota. We want to continue working on development of markets and researching agronomic systems so farmers can add this as an option to diversify the Minnesota agricultural landscape. And with that, we are ready to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Place. We have on this side, Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, as you mentioned kind of the two areas of industrial hemp interest or CBD, and then there's grain production fiber and construction materials. Can you just give us a sense of like how many farmer or percentage of farmers are interested in CBD versus grain fiber construction materials?
Ms. Place.
Madam Chair, at this time about 75% of our applicants in 2019 are interested in CBD production.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One quick question. This place, what we're told is when the hemp seed is going through the extraction process, you get the CBD, but you also get a certain amount of THC, which is the problem here. So what do you anticipate the route to utilize that or get rid of it, or what are you thinking about?
Assistant Commissioner Place. Welcome to the committee, and you can introduce yourself and answer the question.
Chair Poppy and members, my name is Anthony Cordelette. I've been working on hemp with the department since probably 2010, and I currently oversee the program. Just one quick correction. It's actually the flower that they're extracting, not the seed. Seed, that gets confusing because seed does produce hemp oil, which is separate from the CBD oil. CBD has really blown up on us in the last year. So these extractors that are developing, it's been quite a challenge for us to deal with some of these issues. Yes, they are concentrating CBD, but they're also extracting the other cannabinoids, and one of those would be THC. How they deal with that right now, we're sort of in a position where it's you know, legal for them to extract the CBD, but what do they do with the CBD or with the other cannabinoid that would be a controlled one or a controlled substance? So what we're telling them now is to contact local law enforcement and talk to them about that. What would they, what would they prefer they do? How do they dispose of it? How do they destroy it? Most of them are incinerating it right away or composting it, something along that lines. There's no regulation of it, though, yet. And that's something with the new passage of the Farm Bill that we're thinking about. How do we oversee the actual extraction process, and who oversees that? Is it the Department of Ag, or would it be another department like Public Safety or somebody like that?
Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate the presentation today. We will have a couple of bills on Thursday. Representative Vang has a couple of hemp bills, so we'll be hearing a little bit more about it. But we appreciate kind of laying the groundwork here today. And we have nothing further before the committee, so with that meeting adjourned.